Welcome to Drinks with a VC, where we explore the humanity behind investments. Grab your favorite drink and join us as we laugh, learn, and liquor up with some of our favorite venture capitalists.
Whether you're a startup founder, fellow VC, LP, or just curious about the investor ecosystem, you've found the right podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Drinks with a VC. Thanks for joining us via whichever platform you are using to view or listen in. My name is Vic LaQuara. I am the founder and general partner of a seed fund called Green Cow Venture Capital. And as always, I'm joined by my friend and co-hostess with the mostest, Bree Hansen. Hi, Bree.
Hello, Vic. How are you doing?
I'm good. I think one of us has a very special announcement to make.
That is true. I have recently left Berkland, our former sponsor, who we're incredibly thankful for, and am now with Ravix Crew. And I'm very excited about my new opportunity.
Fantastic. Yes. And I do want to second Bree and thank Berkland & Associates for the support and the sponsorship from the very formative episodes up until now. They were fantastic partners. And I'm excited. I'm like very excited because we've got a fantastic guest on today, the podcast, episode 28. He's got such a fascinating story and a very unique path to becoming a venture capitalist, wouldn't you say?
I would say so. He and I have had the, I guess I would say, joy and pleasure of doing transformational breathing together, or breath work, which is pretty incredible. I've known him since I moved to San Francisco. Super excited to have him on today.
Let me get into the intro because we need to reserve all the time we can for the conversation. After graduating from the University of Colorado Boulder with a BS in business management, he moved to LA where he was worked at as an agent in training. 5 years later, he realized his dream of becoming a rock star as a drummer and manager of a band that signed to Epic Records. They toured with Santa Gold, opened for Third Eye Blind. They've appeared on the Letterman and Jay Leno late night shows. Rolling Stone even named them as one of the six artists who defined pop and rock in 2008. When they disbanded after 4 years, he did whatever every musician does. He became an entrepreneur. Heads first as a founder of a music management licensing company, and then as a director of marketing and strategy of a YC-backed nonprofit dedicated to developing and distributing an HIV vaccine called Immunity Project. He was also the head of business development for a digital marketing group called SparkArt. And in 2015, he made his move into venture and launched his first fund, Ranch VC, making investments in companies like Quip, Albert, Imperfect Food, and Simbi. Then he connected with Jordan Chapman and started Alpha Bridge Ventures. Just last month, they closed Fund 2 under the new fund name of Pure Ventures. Please welcome the pride of Glenbrook North High School, Howie Diamond. Howie, welcome.
Wow, what an intro. The pride of GBN.
The pride of GBN. Cheers.
Cheers. Fun fact about GBN. John Hughes, the famous director, was from the suburbs of Chicago, and a lot of his 80s movies were filmed at Glenbrook North, at my high school. What? So the famous scene at Ferris Bueller's Day Off, when Ferris dresses up like the dad to pick up his girlfriend in front of the school with the principal out there, that's our performing arts center. And then at the end of Breakfast Club, that famous scene, like the very last scene when Judd Nelson pumps his fist in the air on the football field, that's my football field.
Tell us a little bit about your early days growing up in this idyllic town of Northbrook.
Oh, yeah. It was very sheltered. It was a suburban bubble. A lot of Jewish parents want to raise their kids there because it's safe and it's got some of the best public schools in the country. I had incredible friends, and we all were obsessed with the Bulls, obviously, in the 90s, because they were arguably one of the best teams of all time, or a dynasty. Yeah. Every kid had a basketball hoop on their driveway, and everyone wanted to be like Mike, like that commercial. If you haven't seen that movie, Air, I highly recommend it. It's incredible. We all had, everyone wanted to have the new Jordans, the shoes when they came out. Everyone played basketball. I still play basketball today. So it was like a big part of my upgrade. Chicago is a big sports town.
Yeah.
I never played organized sports because I realized I have a problem with authority. So when a coach is telling, like barking orders at me, I don't like it. So I was a big recreational intramural sports guy. Some of my friends dubbed me as like the athlete that could have been, but never was. I was big in basketball, and then skiing doesn't really make any sense being from Chicago, but I was really drawn to skiing. My parents would take us on ski trips, and the only place that we could really go skiing was Wisconsin, which were like these man-made shitty hills called Wilmot and Alpine Valley. Alpine Valley's famous because there's a bunch of, it's a music venue too. I think it's where Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter crash. But I was obsessed with skiing, and I actually went to University of Colorado Boulder mostly to go skiing. Didn't really care about learning, didn't really care about, school was not my thing for a long time.
Already in school, nope.
Yeah, I just wanted to be out in the world and experience new things and be with my friends for the first 20 years of my life.
Mom and dad choose the idyllic neighborhood, which I think anyone who grew up in the 80s or 90s probably pictures where you grew up as the iconic American place to grow up, because you're thinking Home Alone, Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that's pretty much where you live. So who are the Diamonds?
It reminds me, one of our favorite movies we watch as a family is We Are the Millers. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes.
We're not like that, but...
You're not going to Mexico and bringing drugs over?
No. But we did have some fun family adventures. So if there was a movie, We Are the Diamonds, you're asking what would that plot be? It would not be as exciting as We Are the Millers, I'll tell you that. But it was good. My dad is an accountant, and my mom is an artist, and my dad was a partner at his accounting firm. And so I have a hybrid brain, literally genetically, like half my brain is business and half my brain is creative. Yeah. And when I was in my artist phase doing the band thing, which I've always viewed as looking reflectively, like the band was like my first startup. I viewed that as a business more than anything. I played drums in the band. But I was like a co-founder with my partner, Lucas, and Lucas did most of the creative in terms of writing the songs, and I was handling most of the business.
Yeah.
And also writing my own drum parts and playing drums. So I view that as my first company as an entrepreneur. I learned an incredible amount managing the band and just learning by doing and failing and then figuring it out. So I'm a very like experiential learner, just like the classic entrepreneur. Just jump in, go in full force, and then like somehow figure it out. But yeah, so my dad's an accountant. My mom's an artist. And I just have this brain that I tap into both sides. And it's been really helpful for me in all aspects of my career, from the music industry into what I'm doing now. I try to find creative ways, obviously, to run my own business and my own fun, but also try to find creative ways to help the portfolio companies market and brand and find new ways to distribute their product and communicate their product and new content ideas. I'm constantly trying to find those creative outlets to tap into. So it's a pretty normal childhood. Nothing too crazy. I guess a couple fun facts. If you want to hear some fun facts, Bree?
Please. Yes.
Vic? Okay. My parents got divorced when I was like six, and they got remarried to different people when I was like 9 or 10. So I grew up with two families. My step family on my dad's side. So the woman that my dad married, her name is Susan. And her previous, and her name's Susan Diamond. So my dad's name is David Diamond. He met a Susan Diamond and comes to realize that the reason her name is Susan Diamond is because her previous husband was also named David Diamond.
Oh,
what?
That weird.
Yeah. So my stepmom married two David Diamond.
Oh. She doesn't have a type. She has a name type.
She has a name. She really wanted the last name Diamond, because that's a great last name.
It is a good last name.
Now, when I say that the David Diamond number one and David Diamond number two couldn't be more different, like literally they couldn't be more different, but they have the same name. And yeah, it's a fun fact. And the other fun fact is that she has two kids, a son and a daughter, and the son, Craig, is my age. We were actually friends in seventh grade. We were friends, and then we became brothers. And Craig was the most popular kid in high school, or in like junior high school. He was a four-sport athlete, got all the chicks. I was a nerd. But by default of becoming his brother, I immediately got propelled into the popular group.
A quick question. You mentioned, obviously, the band, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. But
yeah.
Did you become a drummer in high school? Were you just into music?
Literally, at my bar mitzvah in seventh grade, the bar mitzvah band took a break, and I went over to the drums and started playing. I have no idea why. And Dad ran over and he's like, all right, you're taking drum lesson.
Really? Were you good?
I guess I wasn't terrible. Yeah. I had a natural ability. And then I started a band in high school. We were in a Grateful Dead cover band. And so our house was the house that we rehearsed in. So definitely backfired because we would be playing loud music all day long. The dog would be shitting everywhere.
Were you guys jamming like the Grateful Dead, or were you just copying the jams of the Grateful
No, we were improvising. We were doing our own thing. I'm a huge, fun fact, I'm a huge Deadhead.
Look,
I'm wearing a hat that says Don't Trip. That was really like my foray into music was the Dead and Phish.
And Phish.
The jam band scene.
Before we get into the band stuff, there's so much stuff that I want to cover here.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned two people, your dad and your stepmom, as being huge influences. And in our onboarding questionnaire prior to this podcast, you listed two ex-girlfriends as two of the most influential people in your life. I just want to know why. Are these ex-girlfriends from high school? Are they from college? Are they from adult life?
I can't give names, but the reason why they're so influential was because they're both entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And so it was like the first time that I was in a situation where like I felt understood, and it was also like really inspiring, and they challenged me to grow in my career. That wasn't just like a mentor in a professional setting that was helping me grow. It was like my significant other. I can come home and talk about my day and they would understand it in a way that other people couldn't. Okay. Right. And the first one really got me to think more entrepreneurial. Because again, I talked about the band being like my first company, and then I started my own music management and licensing company. But like at the time, I wasn't really thinking about myself as an entrepreneur. I was just like doing things. Yeah. And she was constantly like pushing me to go further and to apply the learnings from music into like my next thing. And she was actually the one that brought me to San Francisco because she started a company that got some funding. We were living in LA at the time. I was so sick of the music industry. I was just like, I'm done with music. I've gotten everything I needed to get from it. It's time to move on. And she's, I got to go to San Francisco to start this company. I was like, cool, I'm coming with you. I like just rode her coattails in. That was an inflection point in my life. Had I stayed in LA, I don't think I'd have the career that I have now in venture for sure.
Sure. So between seventh grade and then that second inflection point post band, those are like the two major life events that happened. Early on.
What happened in seventh grade?
Oh, seventh grade, popularity. You found the love of the drums, right?
Became popular.
Popularity, the drums.
Became popular, which like gave me the confidence to play drums.
Got a brother, right?
Got a new brother. That was an inflection point. We'll move it. Starting the band in college.
That's right.
And then deciding to, when we graduated, to move to LA and do it for real. That was another big decision, obviously.
What was that conversation like when you were huddling with Lucas, with Tad, I believe, and you're all at the University of Colorado Boulder, and you're saying, okay, we want to take this to the next level. We're going to go to LA.
I was like, let's fucking do this for real. Which in hindsight, like I had so much confidence that we were going to make it, just blind. I didn't care. And you hear this story a lot, right? It's almost like when you don't know any of the rules, you can break all of them. There was never a doubt in my mind that we were going to make it. Yeah. It was just that unfettered, just optimism. And it was just a question of how and when we were going to make it. But I just believed in it so much. And I think one of the things that I did strategically as a manager was start working at CAA because whether I was conscious about it or not, I wanted to learn more about the music industry. And so working in the music department at the top agency in the world and getting mentored by one of the top agents in the world really helped me as a manager manage my own band and get paid to learn, which I think is a life lesson that I want to teach to everyone out there. And paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to learn in a classroom, I found it to make more sense to go out there and get mentors on the job skills training through a mentor and get paid to learn, because I thought those skills were much more applicable. And so that's been like the sort of methodology of both of my careers. So it's helped me become a better manager, learn the music industry from the inside out, and then also give our band sort of an unfair advantage, because I had all these relationships now with agents and managers and had all these connections. And with anything, it's all about...
Wikipedia will tell you a lot of things. And Bree and I went down the rabbit hole of learning more and more about the band that was called Low versus Diamond. But before it was called Low versus Diamond, it was called 1984 and then Colored Shadows. And then something happened on one fateful night. You got into a fight with a former bandmate's girlfriend named Low. Bree and I are both dying to understand what was this fight about.
This is a little bit hyperbolic. Like I think our publicist went a little too far with this. Because like the story exactly piqued your interest, right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
It piqued everyone's interest and everyone likes a little bit of drama. It wasn't basically what happened was Ben started the band with Lucas and I in Boulder. And when we moved to LA, Lo was Ben's girlfriend and we just had creative differences. Yeah. Myself and Lucas wanted to take the band one way and Ben and Layla wanted to take the band a different way. So Ben and Layla just went their own route and Lucas and I went our route. And ironically, we realized that Ben was holding us back. And like within a year of Ben leaving is when we got signed, because we were focused on Lucas's songs and Lucas's songs had more commercial appeal for major labels. Was it spiteful to rename the band Low versus Diamond? Maybe, but it was representative of like how everything went down. And we were shocked how it all went down, because at the time we thought the band was going to end when Ben left, because it was one of the three core members. We're like, oh, Ben's gone. Let's throw in the towel. That's it. But we're like, no, let's give it one more shot. Lucas will do all of your songs and let's see what happens. And then within a year we were signed. And okay, we didn't see that coming.
That's amazing.
Pretty crazy.
Did you call her Yoko for a while?
I never called her Yoko. And call her Yoko.
I tease. Why don't you go ahead and open box A that we have delivered to you to represent. Okay. Your first part.
I forgot which one's A.
It should have your band's name on it.
Oh, those are these.
Oh, yes. That's good. The Low versus Diamond mugs. So we decided to go with a merch theme since you are a former band member. So you'll be getting merch today that represents your things in your life. We started with Low versus Diamond. Now, what was funny about the verses, Howie, is I've known you a long time and I would call you a lover, not a fighter. So I thought it was really funny that you had this backstory of fighting and you made it this like head to head.
There's always going to be fights in life. It's just, how do you fight well or do you fight? Like it's how you fight is what matters. Sure. So I like to think that we ended things somewhat amicably, but I don't think they liked us for a while. But
you just put it in your band name.
Did you feel like being the LA scene? With the band scene, you create music. You've got Don't Forget Sister coming out. It's ranked 59 out of 100 on Rolling Stone's top 100.
I guess I've done your research.
But you're there. And now how surreal is it to be on the Letterman show and on Leno?
No, it was a dream. I remember, man, I had like boundless energy in my 20s. So I started in the mailroom at CAA. They want you to start from the ground floor. And I just had this relentless pursuit to achieve. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what I was proving or who I was trying to prove it to, but I was like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make this successful. And that meant working 10 hours a day at CAA in the mailroom, working up to the music department, working for one of the most demanding agents in music, Jeff Frasco, who's a good friend of mine now. We were friends back then, but he was my mentor. So working 8 to 10 hour days, no more, 10 to 12 hour days at CAA, and then going straight from CAA to the music studio, which was downtown LA on 7th and Santa Fe, called Downtown Rehearsal, back in the early 2000s. It's not what downtown LA is now. Even now, it's sketchy. There's still some really seedy areas down there. There is one of those elevators where you have to pull the gate down.
Yes.
Like two different gates. It was an industrial elevator, and there was like 75 different little rooms, like dorm rooms, that every band in LA were rehearsing in. I would just go straight from work to downtown rehearsal and rehearse for 4 hours. And I literally did that 6 days a week for 4.5 years. And we were partying because we're a band in LA in our 20s. I was burning the candle so hard at every, you know, on both ends. And then to finally see it somewhat pay off. The irony is it never really paid off monetarily, because even though we got a 7-figure record deal from Epic Records, like, that money did not go in our pocket.
Sure.
No.
Sure. Newsflash for every musician out there. It's like most of it went to recording costs and video production and touring and all that. So we were still living very frugally, but we're getting paid to live our dream, to be musicians, working musicians. And we were touring eight or nine months out of the year. We were on the road, and it was incredible playing the late night shows. We released one album, and I'm still very proud of it. And everyone should go to Spotify and listen to it.
It's amazing.
I still get a couple, still get 10 cents every month for the royalties on that.
I feel like I contributed to that royalty check this week leading up to the show.
Thank you. So it was incredible to look back. I don't even realize at the time, because again, I thought it was, in my mind, it was a foregone conclusion that this was going to happen. So it wasn't even like that surprising to me. But looking back on it, I was like, wow, that actually took a lot of work and time and energy and effort. And it's amazing when you like set your mind to something and you have the such talent in place. And this is all metaphors for startups, right? You can achieve it all. And the funniest thing is my parents never understood why I was in a band. And they would always give me shit for it, especially when I left CAA I was going to be offered an agent position at CAA the same month we got a record deal from Sony.
Wow. That's like a movie.
Yeah. And I had a bunch of conversations with trusted people in my circle of friends and family, but ultimately it was the head of music at CAA. His name is Rob Light. Everyone knew I was in a band. I didn't keep it a secret. And I told him my situation, and he said the wisest thing that he could have said, and I still remember it to this day, which was, go do your band and have that experience, and go on that journey, live that dream. The door will always be open for you at CAA, and the experience that you get as a musician, if you ever want to come back as an agent, this will make you a better agent because of that experience, because you'll be an artist and you'll be able to relate to other artists in a way that other agents can't.
Yeah.
And it's the same way when like VCs or former founders, they can relate to founders in ways that if you got an MBA and you've just done business school your whole life, you can't relate to what it's like starting a company. So he made it easy for me to go do the band thing. And I never went back to CAA. I really am grateful that I had that conversation with
him. I want to get into the operational side in a minute. But first, you mentioned two bits that I'd like to just dive a little bit deeper into. The first is the lifestyle. And I think as of late, Silicon Valley has gotten even more flack for a certain lifestyle that people outside of Silicon Valley and even people inside of Silicon Valley believe that founders follow, right? It's work hard, play hard. And there's almost this kind of mentality outside of Silicon Valley that, man, there's got to be like this underground party scene, et cetera, in Silicon Valley. You've experienced the lifestyle of a rock star. You've also been a part of Silicon Valley for quite some time. Is there a truth to that? And do you see parallels in both those lifestyles? Because again, getting to that second point, you mentioned burning out of and being sick of LA. And I wonder, are there parallels there more than we'd like to see?
For sure. I think it's a function of age more than anything. I think in your 20s, you have the stamina to work hard, play hard. And I saw that. I saw parallels to that in Silicon Valley with the younger founders that were going out and partying every night. And it was very similar and representative to what I was doing when I was in a band in LA in my 20s.
Yeah.
I was able to handle it in my 20s. I could operate on 4 hours of sleep. I was super resilient. My recovery rate was super fast. I know, I just think you're younger and your body can just deal with it.
Yeah.
I personally have a whole new philosophy around drinking and partying. So I don't really think it served me. It was really fun. I'll say my 20s were the most fun I've ever had. Some of the most fun I've ever had, but
yeah.
It was fun for my 20s because I wasn't, I'm going to get into some philosophical mentalism here, but I wasn't fully aware of who I was and what I wanted. I wasn't actualizing what was right for me. I was just, which I think a lot of people do when they're younger, is they just adapt to the climate or the culture or the environment that they're in. I'll go all the way back to what we talked about when I was young and I was in the popular group. When you're in the popular group, you have to do what the popular kids do, which is a party. And then I went to Boulder, which was a big party school, and I wanted to be accepted. So I partied in Boulder and I skied. I loved skiing. So I did, that was true to my, what I wanted to do. But, and then I moved to LA and I was in a band. And when you're in a rock band in LA and in your 20s, guess what you do? You party. And I never even questioned it. It was just like, that's just what you do. And then it becomes habituated into your life. And then that just becomes a part of your identity. But it took me until I was like 35 years old to be like, wait a minute. I don't even think I like alcohol.
Wait, I don't even like to party.
I was just going through the motions of things when I was younger. And then you start becoming aware of like how it's affecting you cognitively. It shows up. Yeah. Physically, emotionally, mentally, it really starts to take its toll. And maybe it didn't show up as prevalent in my 20s. It definitely, there was a lot of days where I was hungover in the mailroom at CAA. And there was a lot of days, I think when I was working on the music for the partner in the music department, his name is Jeff Frasco. You actually couldn't be hungover working for him. So that kind of kept me more balanced.
On the straight and narrow.
You had to be on it. And my philosophy now is, and then I really stopped drinking and I pulled back on all the partying, A, because I got it all out of my system and it just stopped being fun.
Yeah.
But B, I think John Mayer said this or someone, because when he stopped drinking, he said he wanted to operate at 100% of his potential.
Sure.
And so when I was transitioning out of music to venture to a new career that I had really no experience in, and I wanted to learn everything, I wanted to take a very autodidactical approach and like just learn as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to have any excuses not to fall short. And yeah, I really pulled back on drinking. And then when I started my first fund, I just didn't want to have any excuse to not perform at my highest level. And especially when other people were giving me money. So
yeah. That's
when I cut drinking out completely. I still drink wine every now and then, but anyway, to go back to your question, I see it. I see people partying that are younger. I don't see it as much as people get older. I see it fade away. So that's why I think it's really a function of age.
Yeah. You went into like the popularity, winning the popularity lottery as being a rock star, to then having your ex-girlfriend really be a catalyst for you moving back up to the Bay Area. And you link up with a YC startup. How did that happen? Because now you've won the popularity contest of the startup world, right? You've got it in with a YC company.
Yeah. So Jeff Frasco was a big influence in my life on the music side. And I think that's what helped my band succeed. And then my first job in San Francisco was working at a startup studio called Spark Art and who Naveen Jain, not the astrophysicist, there's another Naveen Jain, who was running that company. And that was another just incredible experience to work under a guy who took me under his wing, gave me a business development role, and I got to learn this ecosystem and this industry from the inside out. And SparkGrowth was this startup lab slash kind of agency model where there was like 25 employees. We worked with a lot of high-end sports brands and artists. So we basically like ran, we were like the CTO for Lil Wayne and Bon Jovi and Carrie Underwood and Janet Jackson and like some of these big artist brands. And that's why I think Naveen wanted to work with me, because I had the music background. And then we like ran all their websites. We handled their fan club, VIP ticketing services, et cetera. And then we'd come up with innovative ideas to bring to their like new ways to engage and monetize their fan base, et cetera.
Sure.
We also worked with sports brands like UFC and like Pro Bull Riding and a few others. But then there was this startup lab incubator where we would like, Naveen would spin out companies out of SparkGrowth. And one was like Redbox Tickets, you know, like the Redbox, they don't really exist anymore, but they were the DVD rental company. Right. So he started selling concert tickets. He like used it as a ticketing distribution mechanism to promote and sell concert tickets as a discovery of concerts in your area. And then you could buy the tickets right there. So we spun out, we partnered with startups, helped accelerate them. We came up with our own ideas. We had the full suite of services to bring an idea from zero to one. Mm-hmm. We did everything from marketing, branding. We had a front end, back end development team. We had a 25,000 square foot fulfillment center that did everything from point of sale to pick, pack and ship to fulfillment. We launched Donny Osmond Home, which was a big home furnishings brand for Donny Osmond. I call it my 4-year MBA program, Silicon Valley MBA program. I got to sit front row and got a fully comprehensive, immersive education around startup world on every aspect. And then he launched a venture arm. So that was my sort of foray into watching how to build a portfolio, how to diligence companies, how to source deals, et cetera. So the Immunity Project came out of the incubator.
Okay.
We partnered with a doctor who was working on a novel vaccine for HIV. And I know nothing about biotechnology. I was way outside of my purview. The science was validated. And then I helped on the marketing side tell the story. And I had to learn about the science. And I had to learn how to distill this complex science into palatable narratives that people can understand. And we ended up being one of the first 3 or 4 nonprofits to be accepted in YC winter 2014. So it was, all of this was just being in Silicon Valley from 2011 to 2020, pre-pandemic, just incredible energy, fertile environment, going out, meeting people, so much serendipity and optionality happening. Like you have one conversation with someone at a bar that leads to something else that leads to there's so many networking events. I just fully dove in to that ecosystem and didn't come up for air for 10 years, then somehow became a venture capitalist when I did.
But you came up for air and you went back to the CPG roots. And so Ranch VC was born. How did that happen? What was the catalyst to bring that to fruition?
Basically, I just took the learnings that I got at SparkGrowth and then at some point had the confidence and courage in 2015, I had the confidence and courage to be like, hey, I think I could do this on my own. And then also there were people in my network who were not in Silicon Valley who saw what I was doing out here and were like, hey, we like you could be an access point for us potentially. Like what you're doing seems really cool. Like, would you invest in companies? It was like organic inbound interest that was like, here, take 50K of mine and see if you can do something with it.
Yeah.
So two things, like one, a lot of my friends were founders that were starting companies that were becoming very successful. And I was like, it can't be this easy. Yes. 3 of my friends built companies that were $100 million businesses. And I could easily have gotten in if I had money. Yeah. They're my friends and they would take my money. I didn't even know. I didn't have the money at the time. And I didn't even know what questions to ask. But it was just being at the right place at the right time, knowing the right people. And then my uncle, who's a realist, his name's Rick Levin, and my aunt, her name's Kimberly Weiner. My uncle runs a real estate business in Chicago, and they're big real estate investors. They own a bunch of property in Chicago. And they thought it was like really cool what I was doing out here. And so they actually gave me the first, they wrote the first check into Ranch Ventures. And then that kind of got things started. And then I was like, you know what? I'm seeing so many companies with an idea on a whiteboard. Mm-hmm. Again, this is like 2013, 14, 15, 16. Yeah. Like I could raise a couple million dollars for a fund. I've seen really dumb ideas raise a couple million dollars. I could raise a couple million dollars. Come on. That's something I could do. And so it was not easy because I was a first-time fund manager, solo fund manager, had no track record, but I just went out there, shook a lot of trees, pounded the pavement, and somehow scrounged up $2 million for the first fund. And it was as generalist as you can possibly imagine. No thesis, no like concentrated equity strategy in terms of like ownership. I was literally like, I need to put points on the board, establish a track record, and prove to myself and my early investors that I can pick winners. Sure. And I just want to write like 50K checks to do that. And that was basically what Ranch Ventures was.
And you did, and you found the Quips of the world, the Alberts of the world, and Perfect Food. Simbi, I know I'm missing a bunch here, but you were very successful in your own right starting 2015. And you've always been more consumer CPG focused. On the other side of the equation now, you meet Jake. And Jake isn't really consumer focused by nature, but you two hit it off. How did that come about?
We met on the pitch.
Okay.
Season one.
Met on the pitch. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Season one or season two.
Okay.
And we mostly bonded around the founder mental health stuff, which I know that you want to talk about.
Yeah.
So he was a solo fund manager running Gelt Ventures. I was a solo fund manager running Ranch Ventures. We were bonded on like the shared misery of running our own respective funds by ourselves. So we would meet up once a week and just vent to each other and try to help each other. And then we started talking about what we were going through personally as fund managers and how taxing it is to our own mental health and wellness. And then we started talking about how our founders are going through the same thing. And this is like a pervasive problem and no one's talking about it. And that's when the light bulb went off for us to do something about it. So the primary reason I got into venture is that I wanted to try and solve some of the world's most existential problems through investing. I was drinking the Silicon Valley Kool-Aid around. I want to help make a dent in the universe and solve these huge problems. Sure. I came to realize that nothing has the speed, scale, and positive feedback loops of solving these problems more than early stage private sector combined with an abundance of cash flow. Yep. So when I launched Ranch Ventures, I wasn't a CPG fund specifically. I set out to dedicate it to technologies that I felt would improve the planet's future, which were in like biotech, healthcare, AI, finance. But then I just saw an opportunity and I understood the consumer sector as just in a way that I didn't really understand these other sectors because I don't have a background in biotech or healthcare or AI, but consumer just made sense to me. But I wanted to invest in consumer companies that had some kind of angle, like better for the environment or
upcycled
like
food,
beverage. I dabbled in a bunch of different sectors, but then I found myself enjoying investing under the consumer umbrella, which was everything from consumer hardware, consumer software, CPG, e-commerce, direct-to-consumer, subscription models, marketplaces, et cetera. So there's a lot that falls under that. And then I met Jake, who was more investing in frontier tech, which was under that is biotech, aerospace, AI, autonomous vehicles, technologies, companies that have a much higher bar for scientific and technological complexity. Mm-hmm. And that was his domain expertise. So we put the two together and came up with this barbell approach investment strategy. Focusing on consumer and frontier provides us with this really interesting diversified model of investing in terms of liquidity timeline plus risk profile plus return multiples.
Yep.
So like, for example, the exit timelines between frontier and consumer heavily favor consumer.
Sure.
Because M&A activity is like much more prevalent in that under the consumer space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we can get liquidity faster and return our investors' principal much faster from our consumer deals, while the larger return multiples favor the frontier tech companies that Jake's looking at. But it has a much longer runway is required to build those types of products and companies. But there are opportunities to sell the IP before these companies even go to market in certain select cases. But our thinking was like, okay, consumer will give us quicker liquidity. They probably top out at like 250 million, 500 million is like where the top successes and our consumer brands are going to cap out at. But we're investing in like $15 million, $20 million valuations. So still, that's still a great outcome.
Sure.
But like the $1 billion decacorns are going to be in the companies that Jake's building that are going to happen year 8, year 9, year 10, but the consumer liquidity could happen as early as year 2, year 3, year 4. So we devised an investment strategy around that thesis.
What really intrigued me and drew me to what you and Jake were building early on was this other piece that you mentioned, right? Around founder well-being and mental health and mental wellness. And it always surprised me that the spotlight always shines on mental illness and wellness when tragedy strikes, right? When the Aaron Schwartz of Reddit commits suicide, or Tony Shee at Zappos, or Unfiltered's Jake Miller, John McAfee, right? We talk about all of these folks, and then it gets put under the rug and not talked about, and it's until another tragedy strikes. And it always surprised me because, again, and I'm quoting an Entrepreneur magazine article, one physician conducted some research and said 72% of entrepreneurs that he interviewed reported having mental health concerns. And as venture capitalists, we always say to our founders, we're going to let you do what you do best, and we're going to help take care of all of the fringe stuff as part of the value add that we provide beyond the check. But rarely do you see VCs, if ever, really focusing and incorporating that focus on the mental health of their founders into their thesis. And that was something that I thought was just so brilliant, so blatantly obvious, and something that all of us as venture capitalists should strive to do. And I'd love to dig into that, both in the context of, look, when you first started Alpha Bridge and before Leia began, how hard was it to strategize around this and bring this into your thesis and fold it in and then bring that to your founders?
It's a classic startup story. Like I said, in my 20s, I wasn't dealing with any of this, any issues of like burnout or stress or anxiety. I'd always acclimated to the stress in my life, and it just, just became normal. It wasn't until I moved to San Francisco and ended up really starting my first fund, and I was like 35, is when I started really experiencing the problem firsthand. I think I experienced a little bit as an artist during the band years, and then as a founder for the music management and licensing company, I think I was dealing with some things, but I wasn't really aware of it. When I started my first fund, there were signals that my body was giving me that like things were not okay.
Yeah.
I actually had a panic attack on an airplane. I was in Europe. Because my first fund, I was like, I need to overperform on every level. I need to make this a success. I'm putting all my eggs in this basket. I got to do whatever I can to make this happen and to make this successful. The thing about being a venture capitalist is you don't know if you're successful until 5 years in. So a lot of it's like speculative. But I wanted to do whatever I could to build my reputation and be a very value add partner to the companies I was investing in and be a great steward of capital to my LPs. So I would overperform on like reporting and communication to my LPs. And then I would like literally go, and I flew to Europe for one of my portfolio companies to negotiate international distribution deals to help them grow internationally.
Yeah.
And I was overseas in France representing one of my portfolio companies. And the day before I was supposed to come back, I was also simultaneously raising money for Ranch Ventures, my first fund. The day before I was going to come back, one of the anchor investors in my fund told me he was pulling out. And I had already made commitments to other deals, and it was like, it really was like a jolt to my system that I think broke me in a way. And on the plane ride back from France, I like literally had a panic attack on the plane and didn't know what was happening and couldn't breathe, and went to the bathroom and like breathed into one of those bags. And I was like, they're going to have to do an emergency landing over the Atlantic Ocean. Like, this is crazy. And so I got through that, but then I was like, okay, this is not good. I need to figure out, like, I need help because I'm suffering physically, emotionally, mentally. It was the first time I've ever had to deal with it. And I didn't know who to turn to because I was very shameful about it. I didn't even know what resources or services were available. I didn't even know what I needed. I was going to Google therapist or something. I didn't even know what was actually happening. The services were not accessible. They were not affordable, and they were not necessarily custom tailored to my situations. What I did was I threw up a Hail Mary and I sent a cold email to Brad Feld. And the reason I emailed Brad Feld is because at the time he was the only VC openly talking about like his mental health issues. And I sent him like a 2-page email. It was like, I laid it all out there explaining like what I was going through, and it was just a cry for help. And luckily, thank God, Brad responded within 24 hours, connected me with Jerry Colonna, who's a big startup coach. And Jerry connected me with a coach in San Francisco who were dirt so that I could afford him, and got me on a path of healing. Mm-hmm. But it was such a broken process to get there. So again, classic startup story. I experienced the problem firsthand. I started validating it anecdotally. I think I mentioned Jake and I started having conversations with our founders because I was going through a lot. And then I would start asking them, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I guess investors never ask founders that question. Investors would always ask, how's the company doing?
Right.
How are you? Yeah. And they're like, oh, I'm fine. I'm like, no, how are you really? They're like, no, I'm fine. I'm like, no, I know you're not. Like, how are you really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they would open up, and we had these like wonderfully transparent, like open, honest conversations about what we were going through, because I was going through the same thing. And I realized that this problem was pervasive across the entire ecosystem. Like, literally every founder at every stage and every sector of company is struggling to some degree with these types of things. And no one was talking about it. Yeah. It was like taboo to talk about. Everyone was living this. And so this whole ecosystem was like this false reality of crush it culture. And Silicon Valley was romanticizing and glamorizing what it is to do a startup. And it's, I know what it's like, and it is not sexy, and it is not fun, and it is not what these people are talking about. So let's talk about the reality here, first of all. And I validated it with these conversations, and then we substantiated it further with research and data. I think you mentioned a study. You know, we found a lot in this Noam Wasserman study, who he's the author of Founder Dilemma. He did a study of 10,000 founders and found that 30% of founders suffer from depression and 27% suffer from problematic anxiety.
Yeah.
65% of startups that fail attribute the reason for their failure to people-related problems. And 30% of failed startups cite mental health issues as a key to their failure. So we're like, okay, this is real. And no one's doing, not only is no one doing anything about it, no one's even talking about it. Yeah. So let's do something about it. Let's talk about it. This is now Jake and I brainstorming. And yes, it could be a differentiator for us. But first and foremost, we just think it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I view founders as athletes.
Sure.
You know? And to be the best at your sport, you need a team of coaches. You need a support team around you to build you up in all of these areas. And founders have nothing. They're just supposed to figure it out on their own. Number one, we thought it was just the right thing to do to help founders in these areas because no one's doing it. And we went through it ourselves and had to figure it out, and it sucked. Two, yeah, it could be a sustainable competitive advantage for our fund because this problem exists pervasively and every founder needs these services, but yet no one's providing them. We believe that if we provide these services, we can get into the competitive deals. Founders would take our money over other investors' money because we have something that they want that other investors can't give them. Yeah. And then C, post-investment, this can be a great insurance policy as an investor to know that the founders are getting help in these areas. And this is all in service of leadership development. I want to be clear. Yeah. The core foundational elements of our program, Pilea, are the cornerstone. The tenants are in emotional, mental, and physical health domains, but it's all in service of becoming great leaders, because we fundamentally believe that if you feel your best, you will operate at your highest potential. That's ultimately what we believe. And so Jake and I really brainstormed around all this and really wanted to make this our platform. And then we realized that we're not the ones to run and operate this. So we had to bring on someone who had the domain expertise in these areas. And that's when we met Dr. Carrie Sullins, who is a PsyD in clinical psychology with a concentration in organizational behavior and development, to basically build and run what's now called Pilea, which is the service platform that we apply to all the companies that we invest in.
Fantastic. I think there's a VC gift that we have to open. Potentially. Is that right, Bree?
There's technically two more, and you can show the guests both of them. So this one is our Pure Ventures Diamond featuring, of course, Chapman, because now
not
you're
Diamond versus Chapman. Diamond featuring.
Featuring. Because you're a collaborator now. You're not a fighter. You're And then, of course, the bag, which is Diamond featuring the Solon sisters, because that just sounds like a band right there.
Yeah. Now, I will say this could be a versus, because like
it could be
their first thing I lay off the ground. We had some pretty epic battles about creative direction and business model, but it's all good now.
So Pilea, it's actually named after the Chinese money plant.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't involved in naming Pilea. When we first started, it was called Atlas, and then they changed it to Pilea. So you'll have to switch the name.
I like a lot of the branding. I signed up to be a VC who cares, and so excited about where that will go. We actually talked to a number of founders and VCs before this episode, and we asked them what are some burning questions that they would want to get in front of you on this topic of mental health and wellness, because you're really at the forefront of this. And as a differentiation, this is really important. I think you would agree if more VCs were armed with these tools to check in on their founders, create spaces where their founders can be vulnerable and really thrive, then we'd all be in a better place.
Yeah, that's a key point, actually. So Pilea started as our in-house platform that we applied to every company that we invested in, that we paid for the founders to go through Pilea for the first year. We like literally invested in the people behind the companies and put our money where our mouth is. So that's still the case today, even with our new fund. But we spun Pilea out as a separate organization because there was a lot of inbound interest from other VC firms, other accelerator programs, other companies that were not in our immediate portfolio that wanted access to these services. And so we said we could either keep Pilea proprietary to our fund and keep it close to our chest, or we could open it up to the broader ecosystem, help everyone, or to help whoever wants it. And we chose the latter because we firmly believe that like the value that's created in Pilea by working with as many people as possible will directly be captured back to the fund. And that's been the case. We've gotten introductions to more founders, more fund managers, et cetera, because we're providing something, again, that's really valuable, that we're really proud of, and that actually works. Like, we've been in market for 4 years. And the other thing is that everything that happens in Pilea stays in Pilea. There's literally a confidentiality agreement between the fund and Pilea. So we don't know the specifics of what our founders are going through. We just know that they're getting the requisite help that they need. And we did that intentionally to create that space of confidentiality, privacy, its vulnerability, et cetera. That was really important for us to create that structure to make sure that founders can handle whatever they need to handle and not worry about the specifics getting back to us.
One VC or aspiring VC asked, what are the early warning signs VCs should be looking for in their founders around burnout? And I'm assuming they're talking about isolationism and other things like that. But Howie, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good question, because founders aren't going to willingly divulge how they're feeling to a VC. I've literally asked the question like straight up, hey, you've been doing this for X amount of years. Are you tired? Yeah. Like, how are you feeling? And I gauge their response based on that to see how much more gas is left in the tank. That's a question. Again, Kari and her team, I think, do a better job of like getting underneath the surface of what's really going on.
Sure.
And we will sometimes include Kari in our diligence process.
Okay.
To diligence the team. We're actually coming out with an article about the importance of, we're like uncovering blind spots yeah. when it comes to like due diligence on founding teams. And we feel like that's as important. The sort of founder dynamics and the team dynamics are as important to figure out and to assess as like the business itself. Yeah. And having Kari come on board for that process to do what she does as a psychologist
sure.
to really see what's going on with this person and with this team is incredibly valuable to us. Mm. Out. It's such good timing because we're like literally coming out with this article where we analyze. Now, I don't know how you want to form this into a question, but one thing we think is really important is analyzing complementary skill sets. Like a founding team's ability to complement each other and not be redundant, I think is really important. Assessing what their expertise, experience, and knowledge is, and look for the diverse backgrounds that cover various aspects of the business. Just one founder is proficient in technical skills, one's proficient in marketing, one's proficient in financing, operations, et cetera. So we feel like cognitive diversity is really important, and a balanced blend of skills is going to give them a competitive advantage to tackle these challenges effectively and yeah. foster innovation, et cetera. So I think you could form a question around that in terms yeah. of like, how do you guys complement each other, or what are the sort of skills that you have on the team that are diversified in a good way. I think talking about gauging commitment is another one that we're big on. Passion and conviction are driving forces behind any successful startup. So I think investigating the level of dedication that each team member exhibits is really important. And because like passionate individuals are more likely to persevere through the tough times. And so figuring out the why, I think, of why founders are doing this, and hopefully if it's mission driven versus yeah. money driven, yeah. right? Is this something that when I was doing my band and when I was doing my fund, I didn't know where this motivation was coming from. I just knew that I wasn't going to fail. Failure was not an option. I was going to do everything in my power to make this happen. And that it was just a foregone conclusion. It was just yeah. a matter of when and how. It wasn't if. So yeah. I think pulling that out and seeing if founders are just doing this as because there's like the wrong reasons to start a company. There's the right reasons to start a company. And I think, again, like a lot of people start companies for the wrong reasons, which is more some kind of like a vanity play in some yeah. regards. Being an entrepreneur.
We've all met the grifter who's, I want to be a CEO. And you're like, CEO of what?
I call them entrepreneurs, right?
Entrepreneurs.
Want to be an entrepreneur.
That's a great one. I haven't heard that before, actually.
They love that term in LA because there's a ton of them.
Oh my gosh. There's a ton of them everywhere. Part of our job is to find the real deal operators and executors and entrepreneurs and get rid of all the wannabes.
You know where you see there's a lot of entrepreneurs? This is when you learn everyone's an entrepreneur. When you get on Tinder, everyone is a CEO.
Everyone's right. a CEO. I'm sorry.
Everyone's an influencer. Everyone's a CEO.
Right.
And none of their companies make money.
Yeah. I find one of the attributes, we're talking about resiliency, we talk about complementary skill sets. I look at particularly solo founders, if they're able to delegate and trust their team members to a certain extension, right? Otherwise, if the trust evaporates or if their ability to delegate evaporates, then it's all in them and it's going to come down so much harder on them, right? They're going to yeah. experience anxieties, the hitting walls so much more often.
I think communication and conflict resolution is another huge one.
Yeah.
You can literally just ask the founders these questions like, yeah. how do you guys communicate with each other and how do you resolve conflict?
Sure.
How much, what is your commitment level to this company and why are you doing this company? What are the skill sets that you guys have that complement each other or that are redundant? You can literally just ask those questions and see how they respond.
What do you think about and how do you go about not just enforcing, hey, founder, we really want you to go through Pilea and do this program, but we also want you to think about your founding team and the people underneath you specifically and their mental wellness. How do you go about?
That's all wrapped up in the Pilea ethos. So you believe there's a trickle-down effect that happens when you prepare the founding team and the executive team with these weapons to combat mental health, wellness. But there's a huge culture-building aspect that is like all of these aspects are ingrained or infused in the culture. And then you're building a culture that's going to have these elements that are so apparent in terms of making sure that people are operating at their fullest potential and not burning out, et cetera. But it starts with the founders feeling it firsthand and believing it and experiencing it, and then trickling it down to the other employees, which we believe is going to, you know, help attract top level talent, since there's always been a talent war. I think now more than ever, like labor, there's the labor force has a lot of the power right now. And how do you get people to come work for you? You gotta, I think maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it was about like putting a ping pong table and having as many free drinks and treats or whatever, like perks in the office. I think now it's more about having a work-life flow and a way to operate that you feel inspired and empowered and heard and et cetera. And all these things are about the culture. It's about empathy. It's about communication. It's about leadership. And I think these are the things that attract, you know, people to companies now.
Do you expect the founders to then take the principles that they learn in Pilea and then infuse that into their teams? Or do you feel like it's your responsibility, yours and Jake and the rest of the team, to say, hey, we've given you some of the tools, but we're also going to help you build that culture?
We've expanded the program in such a way where once the founders feel like experience the benefit of Pilea, they'll bring Pilea on in the capacity of, you're our in-house kind of like coaching platform that's going to work with building a wellness culture and going to help us build programmatically build tools and processes that are going to help this company flourish as we scale. Yep. So it's not just doing like one-on-one coaching. It's potentially, we've expanded the program out into being more of like an enterprise type of service that could be involved in every stage of the company's growth, which we've already started doing, which is cool. So sometimes the founders, I guess, could take learnings and apply it on their own, but we've seen that a lot of them want to have some presence of a program like this in-house so that they can, like, from every employee that they onboard, it could be part of the onboarding process for them to speak to one of the coaches in Pilea, for them to understand what services are available and like how these services are ingrained in the company culture.
So I've had the privilege of working with Atlas and Pilea since the inception through TriNet, Brooklyn, and now Ravix. We've sponsored many of your events, and I've seen firsthand the testimony of some of the founders who have said, this is totally the change my relationship with my co-founder. If they're running a marathon, Pilea is like the water they're drinking to keep them to get to mile 26, right? What do you do with those founders who initially push against having this type of thing? There's some defensive mechanism that comes up when suggested. And how do you guys work through that ego?
Yeah, it's a good question. Candidly, I think 90% of our portfolio companies have gone through Pilea in some way, shape, or form. So it's very rare when they don't. Pilea is custom tailored to each founder, depending on what they need, how much time they want to allocate, et cetera. So some founders just want to dip their toe in, start, and then evolve the program, evolve their kind of engagement as they go along. But it's the only times that people have not done it is when literally they've had their own coach or they're working with someone else. So the overwhelming response and sentiment that we get from founders is like, where have you been my whole life? Thank you. I've needed this. If anything, if a founder's, I have everything figured out on my own, like I don't need this shit, it actually is a red flag for us to want to partner with that person. Because one of the core attributes of a founder that I really want to work with and support is someone who has the humility to say, here's what I'm not good at. And it takes a continuous improvement approach. Yeah. If you think you have everything figured out and you're like the best at everything, I'm like, you're delirious and you're, hey, no one's going to want to work with you.
But Tim, we've all met those founders. And
I don't really want to work.
There's a continuum. And we've all met that like founder that's on this side of the continuum. And I'm glad you don't.
Because that's going to create toxic work cultures. Like Vic talked about the extreme examples of founders committing suicide, which is the most tragic. But there's a number of examples of these toxic work cultures too. Yeah. And that stems from the founders. That all stems from the founders not understanding how to lead properly. And it's all an extension of them and them being cantankerous and like the toxic founders create the toxic workplaces. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of companies don't get past that. I've seen so many failures of companies because of toxic cultures, because of co-founder relationships that are super toxic. And so it's all, that's that stat that I go back to, like 65% of startups that fail attribute the reason for their failure to people-related problems. Like that's all under the people-related problems umbrella.
And I'm going to say, I don't think VCs are honest about that, because when I ask VCs why their companies failed, they always say product market fit. And I'm like, BS. I guarantee you they could have had product market fit had there not been co-founder toxicity happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So funny that you mentioned that, because I really do think how you and Vic, both of you are some of the only VCs that are realistic about this. Many just like to put their head in the sand and be like, everyone's just fine. And I have the best founders ever and they don't need any help. They've got it. And I appreciate that you've taken so much to put in content for these founders that can help them get through this. I also wanted to ask you more about the tools that you recommend founders use, both for their mind and for their body and helping regulate the stress and anxiety of being a founder. Cause I know there's a lot of different tools you use.
That might be another Kari question. Personally, I have a coach, I have a therapist, and I have a Theragun. I've been on a long healing journey since I had that panic attack. And it's taken a lot of work to find that sort of balance that helps me, cliche to say, but work smarter, not just harder. There was always this anxiety to work 80-hour weeks. And there was always something more to do. And I realized like the quality of my work was diminishing when you realize that you have to slow down to get further. It's very counterintuitive, but speaking to a coach who has that experience, who has been through these types of things before, has been incredibly helpful. Just to know that you're also not alone, that every founder is going through this. There's a lot of peer group sessions that have been super helpful. I think Bree, maybe you've been to some of those in the events that we've done. So much of this is just realizing that you're not crazy. Like we're all crazy for doing what we do and like thinking that we can just start a company and out of osmosis and bring it into the world and have it be successful and make everyone millions of dollars. That's crazy. But the execution of it and how it's impacting your mental, emotional, and physical health, like that shit's real. And you're not crazy for feeling all the badness that you're feeling. Just know that everyone's feeling it, even though they're portraying that they're not. It's like, that's the false reality that we're trying to kind of dispel. It's like, everyone's going through the same shit to varying degrees. Let's all talk about it, bring it to the surface, and then figure out ways to solve it. And I think literally just acknowledging it through a peer group session and then people like myself and Vic giving founders permission to work on themselves, because we're investors, we're in a position of power, but like literally that vote of confidence of, hey, I'm betting on you with my money. And we believe that if you work on yourself, there's a higher chance of me getting a return on my investment. Like literally there's a higher probability of success if you work on yourself.
Yeah.
Just hearing that from an investor goes a really long way for founders to just take that first step. And in terms of what that first step is, it's different for everyone. And that's why Pilea is so great, because they do a full 360 assessment of every person that goes through the program to figure out what are the blind spots, what are the bright spots in their life, what are the things that they're struggling with, what are the things that they're doing well with, like on a sort of multifaceted scale. And then they bring in the right coaches and practitioners to help in all these areas. Some founders aren't sleeping well. Some founders aren't eating right. They have shitty diets. Some founders, there's like holistic health aspects. Every human is different and very dynamic. And we have to like take a very bespoke, custom tailored approach to it. There's no one size fits all. And that's why this program is so great, because it's hands-on, it's high touch, and it's custom tailored. I don't want to keep pitching the program, but it's
no. Like, so I think it's worth a pitch though, in a sense that resiliency is built from being at your best. This is a time where I think we're in a very toxic market right now, overall, right? Do you feel like Hylea could have worked 2 years ago, but the reason why it's working now and the reason why you're able to close the $20 million fund two, all of these things is because, man, maybe we just really need it right now more than ever before?
I think post-pandemic has something to do with it for sure. Yeah. I think founders have always needed it. And like when we launched in 2018, all of our founders were like, we have the same conversion rate then as we do now. Yeah. But I think it's now becoming more in vogue to talk about it, which is also like a huge part of what we're doing is to make this, to destigmatize founder mental health and make this subject less taboo and just normalize this subject. And I think now in 2023 compared to 2018, it's becoming more comfortable for people to talk about it, which is, I think, really exciting, because now we're getting into some real conversations, not just how's your company? Oh, we're crushing it. Yeah, everything's great, blah, blah. It's, no, like, how are you? Like that question, how are you? I think that's becoming more prevalent now amongst the founder community. And then that will lead to like sharing of resources, and that will lead to more peer groups, and that will lead to just like a healthier ecosystem, because the rising tide will affect all ships. And the more that we can make this make this more normalized within the ecosystem, but also create affordable and accessible services that founders feel comfortable reaching out and applying to themselves. It's almost like this should just be par for the, I mean, this should just be table stakes for every founder who wants to start a company. It's okay. I need my team. I need money, and I need my coach. I need my support group. Those are the things that you need to get started. That should be in the back of every founder's mind, because I think this just, like I said earlier on, I view founders as athletes, and to be the best athlete, you need a great coach and a support team to help you be the best. There is that Tom Brady show on that series on Facebook. Was it called like Tom versus Time or something? Or I forgot what it's called, but like each segment had a different coach that he worked with, and he had nine different coaches.
He needed a marriage coach.
But yeah, but to be the best, some people call him the greatest of all time. He had eight or nine coaches to help him get there.
And I heard, I think it might have even been Michael Phelps. It was some Olympic athlete that said, if I get a coach and they even make me 0.02% better than I already am, that could mean the difference between a gold and a silver. So even just a little bit of performance help can make all the difference. So we're like finishing a hype cycle and beginning a new hype cycle. We're going from crypto and I think a wave of PPP loan funding to now we're starting to see companies running out of money. And then generative AI is coming right behind it to get the new funding. We're going to see, I don't know, a wave of founder failure. What is your advice to the founders out there who have 2 or 3 months left of runway? They can't sleep at night. They are stressed. What do you tell them?
That's a tough one. Okay. I literally came up with an idea for a solution to this, which is basically, hold on, let me pull up. I created a one pager.
That's the most VC thing you said.
Okay.
In this whole conversation.
Because I totally agree with you. And I came up with this idea because we're trying to figure out what our venture studio is going to look like. And I came up with this idea called Rescue and Restore Venture Studio, which is basically a 3 to 6 month program that catches teams of unsuccessful venture-backed companies and resuscitates them by providing capital and a new start to build on previous experiences. Some people got caught up in the hype cycle of Web3 and built the wrong thing, but are super talented operators, and you return the money and start something new. That's my advice. And if we could be literally, if I could institutionalize a program around that, there's a ton of amazing talent that has fallen by the wayside because of what you just said, like the bottom fell out of the market and everything's focused on profitability right now. And there is like very little margin for error as an operator. And so if you're not hitting your like EBITDA milestones and your profitability milestones, like there's just no more money for you to raise. A and B, you're not self-sustainable. So there's no profits for you to live on. So your oxygen is gone. Yeah. So let it go and then take the learnings that take what you learned from that experience and apply it to your next thing. And I think I literally want to start a venture studio program around that thesis. And I think there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines that are like, that need to be put to work. I think things will start to thaw out and that money will start coming back, flooding back into the marketplace in 2024, not just going to AI. So learn from your mistakes from before. Don't just start an AI company. Start a company that actually makes money. How about let's just go back to like business building 101.
together.
Yeah, everyone's focused on not just revenue, profits, Bree.
Yeah, probably true.
Just in my world, maybe in the SaaS world, it's different. And I get in these like deeper tech realms, a lot of times like the IP is worth the most before you even launch. But in my CPG world, it's like you have to make money. Like you have to sell something. Like going back to the most cliched basics, like you have to build something that people want. You have to make it for cheaper than you can sell it for. This is literally going back to like business 101 kind of stuff. But we like forgot about that because we got all like hyped up on like stupid shit.
Yeah. It's all about the revenue and the EBITDA will come later.
Yeah.
Well, until 2023, where every VC is like, where's your EBITDA? And then venture or startups are like, what the hell's EBITDA?
Before we get into our final segment, so if you're a startup founder, if you're a venture capitalist, do we just go to joinpilea.com and sign up for the services and sign up for a concierge call? Is that right?
Yeah, there's a concierge, a free concierge call, but there's like a tab on the front on the homepage, top of the fold that says book a concierge call. And you could get a 30-minute call with one of our coaches and they can walk you through the process and ask questions. And
you do not need to be funded, right, by Pure Ventures. It's completely, entirely open to all.
Yep.
Fantastic. I think that's the key there. In order to propagate this way of thinking, it needs to be as inclusive as humanly possible, as accessible. So I applaud what you, Jake, and Kari, and the rest of the team are doing at Pure Ventures. Are you ready to play 5 questions?
Do it.
Bree and Vic.
So ready.
Fantastic. Bree, let me kick us off.
All right. First question is, what is your go-to karaoke song?
Wonderwall by Oasis. Because everyone knows
that's a good one. That's a great one. I like Talk Tonight by Oasis, but they're both. Go ahead, Bree.
Is a lightning round?
If you could invest in any fictional startup from a movie, TV show, or book, what would it be?
Oh, probably that technology in Minority Report.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Or they could see the murders before they have.
Would you need to have 3?
Like I'd invest in those.
Pool?
Yeah, and like women who are like the cogs. I think
the pre cogs. Yeah,
the pre cogs. Yeah, who could?
Nice.
I'd invest in them.
I think I know the answer to this one, but if you could do it all over again, would you rather be an investor or a builder?
Oh, wow. I like both, but I really like the investor. I like being an investor because I like the portfolio model and not having all my eggs in one basket, but just like being able to help out like every day. I love how dynamic my days are. Like every day is different because I can just jump from one company to another. Also think about ideas for my own business and how to like this venture studio idea, this rescue and resuscitate venture studio idea. I love that. I can spend time on that one day and then help another company another day. And it really works well with my ADD.
I'm a fan of that, by the way. We've got to talk offline about that together. All right. What movie best fits the future of the human race? Is it WALL-E, where we've all degenerated into an obese state due to anti-gravity in the metaverse? Is it Avatar, where we're dominated by this quest for resources, new worlds, and walking around in other bodies? Or is it The Matrix, where it's all a simulation and we're just being harvested for our power?
I was going to do option D, which is Idiocracy.
Oh, I like that.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's nice. Okay. That's a new one. We're going to add that to the list. All right, Brie.
What is the one deal that you passed on that you wish you hadn't?
Ooh, my anti-portfolio deal. I didn't have my fund up and running at the time, but I was really good friends and I'm still pretty good friends with Jack Conti from Patreon. And I remember exactly where I was when he pitched me on the idea. Ooh. And I was a music guy and it's just done so much to help the music ecosystem and to help artists and to get them paid and to have them control their own destiny. Loved it when I heard it, but I just didn't have the money or the wherewithal to even think about writing a check into it. But if I would have written a check into that first round, which was like sub $10 million valuation, I would have done pretty well. Yeah. And that would have been a big one. Also, I'd feel so good about being a part of that because it's just such a good thing for the music industry where I came from, where I can tell you stories about like how toxic that industry was for us and like, you know, in a band and like just not having like creative freedom to do what we wanted to do and being like, yeah, mismanaged by the label. And I don't want to get started, but.
Who actually has good stories about the music industry?
And yeah, like, I don't
know. Like, I've never heard any good story about
people on Patreon have good stories.
Yeah, right.
Patreon users for sure.
They have like direct access to their fans and it's great.
Fantastic. At this point in time, we typically thank you for playing Five Questions with Brie and Vic and have you unpacked a lovely Patagonia vest that has been detailed. This time around, you're going to have to wait for it because Brie and I are excited to unveil some new branding around Drinks with a VC that will come out hopefully at the same time as this podcast is released.
Oh.
So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we would like for you to have the opportunity to cheers us out. And this is your moment to call to attention, something that's really pressing or at the top of your mind. To say hi to mom, whatever you want to do.
I just want to say thanks for having me. It's been a dream to be on Drinks with a VC. And just like it was a dream to be on David Letterman, this is my second dream coming true. Wow. I just want to also clarify, because I talked about a lot about not drinking. This is not alcoholic beer. So I don't want people to think I'm like.
Perfect. That it's absolutely perfect that we were able to do this with non-alcoholic beverages in hand. And cheers to you.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep.
Cheers.
We're so grateful that we were able to interview Howie today and learn more about founder burnout. If you're experiencing mental health issues, please check out Pilea in the links, and you can always reach out to any one of us. My new firm, Ravix Group, just launched an amazing wind down playbook. So if you're going through the end of your startup journey and need help, check it out. Thanks for cozying up and listening to another episode of Drinks with a VC. We are so grateful for our listener support. Feel free to reach out and add any of your questions to the comment section. If you have an idea for a guest or have some feedback, reach out to us on LinkedIn.
If you liked that last episode, be sure to check out our others featuring VCs from Lightspeed, Bessemer, Hannah Gray, BTV, and Norwest. As always, don't forget to like and subscribe. Cheers.